All right, so you know that feeling when you make your monthly mortgage payment and like a big chunk of it just vanishes into this escrow account for taxes and insurance?
Yeah.
Have you ever like stopped and thought, what's actually happening to all that money while it's like just sitting there?
Right.
Well, turns out that very question sparked a pretty big legal battle back in 1981. The case was Brown v. Cameron Brown Co. And that's exactly where we're headed today for our deep dive.
Yeah, and right from the start, what's really interesting here is this wasn't just like a couple of homeowners who were annoyed.
Right.
This is a whole group action, almost like a David versus Goliath situation, where individual people with mortgages decided to take on some pretty big lending companies, and they were questioning how those very escrow accounts were being handled.
Exactly. And for any law students out there who are tuning in, this deep dive is going to be like a mini case study for you. We're going to break down a legal precedent that sits right at the crossroads of finance, class action lawsuits, and even a little bit of antitrust law. And it really shows how, people can use the legal system when they feel like there's this imbalance of power, like the scales are tipped against them.
Yeah, and if we try to zoom out and see the bigger picture here, what makes Brown v. Cameron Brown Co. so important is how it dealt with the complexities of bringing a class action lawsuit in the context of finance.
Yeah.
We're going to look at the actual court documents and the legal analysis to really get to the bottom of what this dispute was all about,
Right.
and crucially, what it means for these kinds of lawsuits in the future.
Okay, so our mission for this deep dive is super clear. We're going to unpack all the main allegations, take apart the key legal arguments, and ultimately, we want to understand why this case even matters, especially when it comes to the challenges of getting a class action lawsuit certified in the world of antitrust law and the mortgage industry.
Exactly.
So let's kick things off. Let's start by going straight to the heart of the matter. What exactly were the homeowners saying? What were their claims?
So basically, the case involved 14 mortgagers to begin with. Brown was the lead plaintiff. And they were alleging that there was this conspiracy among a bunch of lenders,
Okay.
including Cameron Brown, to do away with something called capitalization accounting for the payments people were making into these escrow accounts. Now, this is where things get interesting because it directly affects how much money homeowners end up paying.
Okay, so hold on. Capitalization accounting? I'm not sure I'm familiar with that term.
All right.
Can you break that down for us?
Yeah.
What is it, and why were the homeowners so worried about it going away?
So picture this. Instead of your escrow payments just, kind of sitting there in an account, the homeowners were saying that with capitalization accounting, those payments would actually be used to reduce the principal balance on your mortgage.
Interesting.
So over time, that would make the total amount of interest you have to pay on your loan smaller.
Oh, okay.
The homeowners were alleging that the lenders all got together and decided to stop this practice. So they could basically profit from holding all that escrow money interest free without that benefit going back to the people who are making those payments.
Wow.
And they said this was breaking antitrust laws
Well.
because this alleged agreement stopped competition in the mortgage market and prevented borrowers from going out and finding loans that had this capitalization feature.
So if I'm getting this right, the homeowners felt like the lenders were basically teaming up to make more money for themselves.
Yeah.
And they were doing this by taking away this feature that would have helped reduce people's debt.
Exactly. The homeowners are saying this coordinated action, it limited their choices as consumers.
Right.
They couldn't shop around for a mortgage where their escrow payments would actually help them chip away at their debt
Yeah.
because supposedly all the big players had agreed to stop offering that.
So how did this actually play out in court? Because you can't just make accusations like that without some serious legal moves, right?
You're absolutely right. The way this case moved through the legal system is really telling. Initially, the district court, they said no to the homeowner's request to certify the case as a class action, and they were using Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23B2 for their argument.
Okay, hold on. Rule 23B2. Now, isn't that the rule that's usually used when the main goal is to get an injunction?
Yeah.
To basically force the other side to stop doing something that affects the whole class in the same way. instead of just focusing on getting money back.
You got it exactly right. The district court probably thought that what the homeowners really wanted was money, like financial compensation for what they said was harm done to them.
Okay.
Rather than just a court order telling the lenders to bring back capitalization accounting.
Right, right.
But the homeowners didn't give up there. They filed another motion for class certification. But this time they used Rule 23b3.
Okay.
And that's when things started to change legally.
So what's the big difference between 23b2 and 23b3?
Right.
What made that second rule a better option for them?
Well, Rule 23b3 has different standards. Mm-hmm. It basically says a class action is okay if two main conditions are met. First, that the legal or factual questions shared by everyone in the class are more important than any questions that just affect specific individuals.
Okay.
And second, that a class action is the best way to resolve the issue fairly and efficiently. It has to be better than other options. And the court decided that this alleged conspiracy did create those big, overarching legal questions that applied to everyone.
So let's really dig into the legal stuff here. What specific obstacles did the homeowners have to overcome to get their case certified as a class action under this 23b3 rule?
So first, they had to satisfy the four basic requirements set out in Rule 23a, you know, numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy of representation.
Right.
Then, as we just talked about, they had to pass the two-part test of Rule 23b3, predominance and superiority. It's like a series of checkpoints they had to clear.
Okay, so numerosity, commonality, typicality, adequacy. Let's take each of those and see how they played out in Brown v. Cameron Brown.
All right, well, numerosity is pretty straightforward. It just means that the potential class, the group of people involved, has to be so big that it would be practically impossible to have them all in one lawsuit.
Right.
The court found that a class of, you know, several thousand mortgagers easily met this requirement.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, what about commonality?
Commonality means there have to be legal or factual questions that everyone in the class shares. In this case, the big question was, did the lenders conspire to eliminate capitalization accounting?
Right.
And that question was the same for everyone.
Okay, so that's pretty common. What about typicality? How did the homeowners show that their claims were actually representative of the entire class?
So typicality means that the claims of the named plaintiffs, the people representing the class, are basically the same as the claims of everyone else in the class. The court found that the claims of those named plaintiffs were in fact typical because they all came from that same alleged conspiracy and the same actions by the lenders. The main complaint that capitalization accounting was eliminated because of this alleged collusion, well, everyone shared that complaint.
All right, and what about adequacy of representation? How did the court make sure that the named plaintiffs and their lawyers would actually protect everyone's interests?
So adequacy of representation has two main parts. First, do the class representatives have the same interests as the rest of the class? And second, are the lawyers for the class qualified and capable of representing everyone fairly?
Got it.
In this case, there wasn't any sign of a conflict of interest, and the court was satisfied that the homeowner's lawyers were competent enough to handle the case.
Okay, so they cleared those first hurdles.
Yeah.
But now for the big one, Rule 23b3. What was the key argument that convinced the court that these common questions were more important than the individual ones?
Yeah.
And that a class action was the better way to handle this whole thing.
This is where the legal strategy gets really interesting. The court was completely focused on that alleged conspiracy.
Right.
They were thinking, if the conspiracy existed and they could prove it in court, then everyone in the class was basically harmed in the same fundamental way.
Right.
Because they were denied the benefits of capitalization accounting due to this anti-competitive behavior.
Okay.
And the court even considered the possibility that they could calculate everyone's individual damages using a common formula, which made the argument for predominance even stronger.
Okay, but in antitrust cases, don't you usually have to prove that each person was harmed individually? Like, each person has to show how they were specifically damaged. How did the court deal with that in a class action situation?
That's the big question, and it highlights a really fascinating aspect of this case. The court looked back at past legal decisions and found that if a conspiracy leads to everyone being treated similarly, then the impact of that conspiracy can be figured out collectively,
okay,
at least at this early stage of the case. So basically, if the lenders rigged the system, if they agreed to get rid of capitalization accounting, then everyone who had a mortgage with an escrow account was hurt. They were forced into mortgages without that feature, and the court said, you don't need to prove individual financial loss right away.
So if the homeowners could successfully prove that this conspiracy really happened, the harm to all the people in the class, it would be kind of assumed.
Essentially, yes. At least for the purpose of deciding whether or not to certify the class.
Mm.
The court was saying that to prove this conspiracy, to prove that it was put into action and what its effects were, well, that would involve evidence that applies to everyone in the class.
Got it.
The smaller details of each person's individual financial losses, they could deal with that later in the case.
Okay, so what about the superiority requirement? Why did the court think that a single class action was a better approach than, you know, potentially thousands of individual lawsuits filed by all these different homeowners?
Well, think about it practically. The amount of money each homeowner lost, while it could be significant over the life of a loan, it might not be enough in any single year to justify going through the hassle and expense of suing a huge lending company that has tons of legal resources.
Right.
A class action lets people with smaller but similar claims pool their resources together and go after justice as a group. The court understood that having thousands of separate lawsuits would be super inefficient.
Right.
And it might even mean that a lot of homeowners wouldn't have any real chance of getting their grievances addressed. They decided a class action was the most effective and fairest way to handle this problem.
So for anyone listening who's interested in class action lawsuits, what's the key takeaway from Brown v. Cameron Brown?
Well, this case is a really good example of how important it is to frame the main issue around a central point that everyone shares.
Okay.
In this case, that was the alleged conspiracy. By focusing on that overarching question, the homeowners were able to argue that even if individual damages might be different, the fundamental wrong was the same for everyone.
Right.
And the court's willingness to consider that the impact of the conspiracy could be looked at collectively was also crucial. It shows that even when there are individual issues, emphasizing a central question of liability can be the key to getting a class certified.
So what's the bigger picture here? What does this case tell us about consumer rights and holding companies accountable?
This is potentially a big win for consumers and people with smaller claims.
Right.
Without the option of a class action, it's very unlikely that these individual homeowners would have had the resources to go up against these big lenders and actually challenge their practices.
Right.
Plus, this case sends a message to whole industries that if they engage in collusive behavior, behavior that harms a lot of people, they can be challenged effectively through the legal system.
Okay.
The possibility of a huge class action lawsuit can make them think twice about engaging in anti-competitive practices.
It's almost like the threat of a class action is a way to keep big corporations in check.
Precisely. The fact that people can team up and pursue their claims together through a class action gives them a powerful tool to fight back against alleged misconduct.
Right.
Especially in areas like finance, where individual consumers might feel powerless on their own.
Okay, let's bring it back to our law student audience for a sec. What's the main lesson they should take away from our deep dive into Brown v. Cameron Brown?
For those who are studying to become lawyers, this case shows how important strategic thinking is in class action litigation.
Yeah.
Especially when you're dealing with antitrust claims.
Right.
It really highlights how important it is to identify and clearly explain the common questions of law and fact that everyone shares.
Okay.
That's how you meet the requirements of Rule 23. It also shows how the court thinks practically when deciding whether a class action is the best way to handle a particular dispute.
Okay.
Understanding the nuances of those concepts, predominance and superiority, and knowing how to argue for them effectively, that's key.
All right, so let's say you're on the other side. You're defending a financial institution against a class action like this one.
Mm.
What would you focus on?
Well, if I was defending the company, I'd probably try to highlight how different each member of the class is. You know, argue that the damages are too individualized to be handled efficiently in a class action.
Right.
Or maybe that there are specific defenses that might apply to some people but not others, and that would undermine those commonality and typicality requirements we talked about. The goal would be to convince the court that a class action is not the best way to resolve the dispute.
Yeah.
And that separate lawsuits, however impractical, would be a better fit.
So to sum it all up, in Brown v. Cameron Brown Co.,
mm-hmm.
we saw homeowners claiming that mortgage lenders conspired to get rid of this thing called capitalization accounting
mm-hmm.
for their escrow payments.
Right.
And they argued this allowed the lenders to make unfair profits. Ultimately, the court agreed to certify the case as a class action under Rule 23b3. They found that the shared issues related to the alleged conspiracy were more important than individual concerns.
Right.
And that a class action was the most effective way to handle all these numerous similar claims.
Exactly. And to really drive home the key points, remember how important each part of Rule 23A is.
Right.
Numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy. And then the two parts of 23B3, predominance, and superiority. In this case, the alleged agreement among lenders to get rid of capitalization accounting, that was the central issue that everyone shared.
Right.
And that's what made it possible for the case to be certified as a class action, especially because it would have been really hard for individuals to sue on their own, given that their individual financial losses were probably relatively small.
Yeah. You know, what I think is really interesting is that the court was willing to consider the collective impact of the alleged conspiracy.
Yeah.
So they didn't require each homeowner to prove their specific financial harm right away. That seems super important for understanding how these kinds of class actions can actually move forward.
Definitely. And the bigger picture here is that this case shows how powerful class actions can be in our legal system. It gives a way for lots of people with similar complaints who might not have any other way to seek justice to come together and hold powerful entities accountable.
Yeah.
Without this tool, a lot of potential wrongdoing might go unpunished.
So here's something for you to think about long after you're done listening to this episode. What are the implications for society as a whole? When big industries supposedly work together in ways that might harm lots of individual consumers.
Right.
And what role do class actions play, or should they play, in making sure companies are held accountable and in protecting consumer rights in these situations? How might the principles established in Brown v. Cameron Brown continue to influence future legal battles involving things like financial practices and consumer protection? It's something to really consider.
I agree. This case raises some fundamental questions about the power dynamics between large institutions and individual consumers. And it shows how our legal system is constantly evolving to deal with these complex issues of alleged harm that affects a lot of people.
Yeah.
It reminds us that even the seemingly ordinary parts of our financial lives, like those mortgage escrow accounts, can become the center of huge legal battles with consequences that reach far and wide.
Well said. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive.
Anytime.